corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Thursday. What is today? The 23rd of June. There we go. Welcome back to our program. Oh, so much happening. By the way, the Supreme Court just ruled. This ruling just came down from the Supreme Court. Just ruled that private corporations now, through if they can have sufficient influence on a local community government or a state government, and you and I know where that's, you know, the state of that affair is right now. Private corporations, if they have sufficient influence, now can legally take your property. They can just take it. You know? You didn't need it anyway. It's gone. It's toast. You didn't need that house. You didn't, you know, it's... Yes. Private corporations, well, it has to go through a state government agency. But it... And this, oddly, ironically, weirdly, something like that, this is one of those... This is one of the few cases, I think, in quite some time, frankly, where I have to say I agree with the minority on the court, which in this case was the conservative minority. Justices Scalia, Thomas, Rehnquist, and Sandra Day O'Connor's swing vote. These were the four who voted against this. And Sandra Day O'Connor, she said, any property may now be taken for the benefit of another private party, but the fallout from this decision will not be random. The beneficiaries are likely to be those citizens with disproportionate influence and power in the political process, including large corporations and development firms. That from the dissenting minority of Thomas Scalia, Rehnquist, and Sandra Day O'Connor. Do you get this? And the majority on the court, and I don't get their logic. The majority on the court wrote that, here's Justice John Paul Stevens. He says, the city has carefully formulated an economic development that it believes will provide appreciable benefits to the community, including, but by no means limited to, new jobs and increased tax revenue. And he was joined by Souter, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, and Justice Anthony Kennedy. See, it used to be that you could only take land from people involuntarily if it was for public use. And the reason why was because of the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment just lays this out. First of all, it starts out, no person should be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentation or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger. In other words, you can't be dragged into court unless a judge or jury says, hey, there's an indictment, there's a reason for this. Unless you're in the military, in which case it has its own, you know, the Uniform Code of Military Justice and all that, they've got their own courts. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. That's the double jeopardy clause. You can't be tried for the same crime twice. If a jury acquits you, it's over. They can't come back and try and get you all over again. It makes sense. Nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Now that's the Miranda thing, right? You can take the Fifth Amendment. You can say, I choose not to speak against myself. And of course, Miranda came out of that you don't realize, if you don't realize that you have that right, then you really don't have that right. So you have to have legal counsel and that sort of thing. Actually, Miranda also, as I recall, referenced the Eighth Amendment, the Seventh and Eighth Amendment, but in any case, and the Sixth one as well, probably. Continuing the Fifth Amendment, nor to be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property, now here's the kicker, nor shall private property be taken for public use. I'm reading now from the Constitution of the United States. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, the reason that's in there is so that, on the one hand, to give government actually the authority to take private property, because the Constitution defines some authorities that the government has and limits others. And everybody acknowledged back in the founding of this country that we needed to be able to build a fire station. We needed to be able to build roads. We needed to be able to build a police department. We needed to be able to build schools. And if, you know, private individuals owned all the property, then, you know, how are you going to do that? Okay, so you know, there's this, you know, very straightforward, hey, you know, it's, nobody can take these things unless they're appropriately compensated, but it has to be for public use. It's we, the people, collectively saying, okay, we're all together on this. And, of course, usually in cases of eminent domain, you've got a few people who are saying, no, wait a minute, don't take my house. But the community says, no, we really think that the public value of a road going through here, or the public value of a firehouse here, a public use, overrides the need of you to have your home. And it's tough, it's brutal, it's very painful. I mean, you know, whenever, and government has to deal with these outraged people, and their citizens and their voters and all that sort of thing. But this case in New London, Connecticut, as I recall, it was someplace in Connecticut, a working class neighborhood in New London, Connecticut. There was a woman by the name of Suzette Kilo and several other homeowners were told that the city was going to tear down their houses and replace it with a privately owned for-profit office building. Privately owned for-profit office building. And they said, no, you know, you can tear down our homes and justly compensate us. You can do that if you're going to build a jail or a school. I mean, you know, something that we all agree we need. Actually, I think we have too many jails, frankly, but that's a whole other discussion. If you want to build a school. But you can't do it if you're going to have a private developer come in and at enormous profit take our homes and then turn that land into something that's much more valuable. And local government said, but that private developer, even though they're going to make a profit, those office buildings are going to generate jobs. And so that's a public requirement. That's a public good. And that's apparently the rationale that the majority of the court bought into on this. It's going to be really interesting to see how and hear how the conservative commentators respond to this. Because this is not a conservative position. But it is a corporatist position. And this is the bizarre junction that we've been seeing over the last 25 years, ever since Reagan basically came along and started reinventing the so-called conservative movement. What used to be the true conservative movement of Eisenhower and Goldwater and Everett Dirksen and those kind of guys, into a corporatist movement, a pseudo-fascist movement, if you will, using Benito Mussolini's definition of the term. He actually invented the word that fascism is the merging of state and business interests. And this seems to be one more step down that road. And so what we see in America is that, you know, there still are a few folks who are, you know, who hold to the old true conservative values, Ron Paul from Texas, or on some issues, on many issues, actually, John McCain. But by and large, most of the so-called conservatives out there are actually not conservatives. They're actually corporatists, or what I would say, fascists. And so, you know, and it's going to be interesting to see how they come down on this. Because their instinct, I suspect, if there's any intellectual integrity in them at all, is going to be to agree with me, to say, hey, you know, this is wrong. But however, it's a decision that's going to benefit their corporate buddies. And so, you know, their economic interests are going to be to say this is right. But then the problem is that the so-called liberal arm of the court made the decision. This was Kennedy, Souter, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer, who are at best moderates. And so my guess is that they're going to take on after it, that they're going to be saying the same thing I am, that this is a bad decision, only they're going to be blaming it on liberals. And I'm blaming it on the corporatists. I'll blame it on the cons. And I think this is, you know, this is, we'll see how it shakes out. Time will tell. In the meantime, who are the real traitors? Who is really selling out America? We're having to borrow right now $2 billion a day just to keep the federal government functioning because millionaires and billionaires are no longer paying the taxes that they were 4 years ago. You know, George W. Bush cut the taxes on millionaires and billionaires to the point where we can't run our government. It's just that simple. We had a surplus under Bill Clinton, and that surplus went away, and it went away in large part. The majority of the surplus is gone, not because Bush's economy is gone into recession, although that didn't help, but and not because there's been such a sudden offshoring of jobs, although that didn't help. You know, so many people now who were making, you know, 70 grand as computer programmers are now making 12 grand as burger flippers. That's not helping, you know, or working at Walmart or something. I mean, that's a problem, too. But that had been coming. I mean, these are all things that have been in place essentially since Ronald Reagan began the conservative war on the American middle class and the American working people. Now, instead, this is, you know, Bush's tax cut for millionaires and billionaires. Plus, not only are we having to borrow almost $2 billion a day just to pay the bills of government, just to keep government functioning, but we also have to borrow $600 billion a year from the rest of the world so we can continue to buy things from communist China. So China is now coming over and saying, hey, we're going to redeem these IOUs. You've got an oil company there, Unocal. And, you know, it was going to build an oil gas pipeline across Afghanistan. 70% of its assets are gas, natural gas assets in Asia. We're in Asia. The former consultant to Unocal was Hamid Karzai. He just happens to be the president of Afghanistan. Unocal was Unocal consultants telling through the U.S. government, telling the Taliban back before 9/11 in May of 2001, you can have a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs, your choice. This was on May 15th of 2001, to be exact. And saying, okay. And now we're building three major military bases in Afghanistan along the pipeline route. Just a coincidence, no doubt. And so the Chinese are saying, you know, that Unocal thing that Chevron's going to buy for, what, $15, $16, $17 billion looks like a pretty good deal. We'll offer $18.5 billion. And Unocal now freaking out. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? So who are the real traitors? Who's really selling out America? Well, Bill O'Reilly has some thoughts on that. I'll share those with you after this. Plus, we'll get to your calls. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. 866-889-8894 if you'd like to be on the program. And, of course, TomHartman.com to drop into our live chat room. We shall return. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
Yeah, the propaganda, yes. It's got to be catapulted.
Razzle dazzle.
Razzle dazzled them, George.
You gave them an act with lots of flash in it, made them believe you were compassionate. Gave them the old hocus pocus. You misdirected them. With 9/11 and Saddam Hussein.
Oh, what a brilliant job it was. Karl Rove,
you played them
you did
right to perfection, despite the fact there's no connection. You razzle-dazzled them, let those blue states complain.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, Bill O'Reilly has redefined for us some terms. Apparently, if you are undermining the administration. See, first of all, he mixes together. He says whatever, essentially, he implies, whatever an administration does is what the government does. In other words, if George W. Bush does something, that's your government doing it. So, you know, Richard Nixon breaking into Watergate, that's your government doing it. So if you don't like that, you're undermining the government. See, this is fascist mentality. This is absolute fascist mentality. To say that somebody who speaks out against the policies of an administration is undermining a government. It is pure and simple fascist mentality. And here, Bill O'Reilly, his thoughts on the subject.
Because you must know the difference between dissent from the Iraq war and a war on terror and undermining it.
Yeah, undermining it would be like flying over to Iraq and setting up a bazooka and shooting American planes out of the air. So, you know, that's clear treason. That would be that would make somebody a traitor. But speaking out against an administration policy, that's not undermining. That is dissent.
And any American that undermines that war with our soldiers in the field.
And now he's going to try and mix, just like the Bush administration does, mix together Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, as if there was some connection between the two, and try and mix together the so-called war on terror that has to do with 9/11 and Iraq, even though we invaded Iraq and it had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11.
Or undermines the war on terror with 3,000 dead on 9/11 is a traitor. Everybody got it? Dissent? Fine. Undermining, you're a traitor.
And then he says...
Got it? So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
There you go. You thought it couldn't happen here, didn't you? Oh, it can't happen here. Don't worry. This is America. We'll never go for that fascist stuff. Ain't going to happen. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Mike in Atlanta. Hey, Mike, what's up? Sorry about that. There you go.
Just as you predicted, Neil Bortz here in Atlanta
yes,
is a real estate attorney gone talk show guy.
Gone bad, yeah, I know.
He is incensed at this
decision. Yeah, and blaming it on liberals, right?
Took off after Ginsburg, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And but he, to his credit, he had predicted a couple of days ago that this would be the verdict.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm like you. I'm a little confused by this. It's not something that I would agree with.
Yeah, this is not a liberal verdict. I think it's an unconstitutional verdict, frankly. I mean, you know,
right.
It's just that's the bottom line for me. Whether something's constitutional or not, whether it's best for the American people or not, this seems to me like a corporatist verdict. And I'm just surprised. It's going to be, you know, it'll be a day or two before we get more information on it. And I've had a chance to actually read the verdict, and so we can have a little more intelligent conversation about it. But
right.
It's fascinating. Thanks for that update.
Thanks.
Appreciate
thanks
it, Mike.
For all you do, Tom.
You're
thanks
welcome.
For all you do.
You're welcome, and thanks for listening there. I do. It's strange times. Strange times when liberals and conservatives are agreeing, but the conservatives are using it as an opportunity to bash liberals, right? Gee, that's predictable. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Come on, come on, because everybody's out for love.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, James in Wisconsin on the line. Hey, James, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Great talking to you. Good to be on your show.
Thank you.
I got a question. Those memos that came out of Britain, what's going on with those?
The Downing Street memos?
Yeah, exactly. I you know what? I just heard a little bit about it yesterday, and I was lucky to catch that. And then I went into the mainstream news, and I heard absolutely nothing about it. What's going on?
I'm guessing, James, that you're not going to hear anything more about it from the mainstream media. They've done their thing. It's been their one-day story. They completely ignored John Conyers holding hearings about it, or a forum on it, let's say, in Washington, D.C. In fact, Dana Milbank in the Washington Post wrote an op-ed column making fun of them, ridiculing the Democrats. And I think that they're just going to stay away from it now.
Really?
Yeah, these guys, you have to understand, the big media in the United States is really not a news industry. The news industry in the United States is not a news industry. It's an entertainment industry. And in order to continue to entertain people, and in order for these entertainers who call themselves news people and news reporters to continue to draw 6- and 7-figure salaries, they have to have access to the White House. They have to have access. That, you know, George Bush has to be willing to take their questions. Karl Rove has to be willing to talk to them. Don Rumsfeld has to be willing to interact with them. And if they start reporting the truth about what this administration is doing, this administration has said, and it's done it. They did it. They announced it day one when Helen Thomas, in George W. Bush's first press conference, Helen Thomas asked one hard question. She was toast. She had been there ever since Truman. She had been asking questions, sitting in the front row. She was always the first person asked. And, you know, the grand dame she worked for the Associated Press, the grand dame of the White House press corps. And she was always asked the first question. George W. asked her the first question. She gave him a tough one. And that was it. She was moved to the back of the row and she was never called on again. And that was their way of saying to these folks, the so-called news media in the United States, if you guys don't play along with us, we're not going to give you access. And I'm telling you, you know, John King, I mean, all these guys, they all know that their salaries depend on not upsetting or angering the White House. And if they anger or upset the White House, any one of the networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, if any of them do it, then they're never again going to get access to the White House, and they're not going to be able to sell advertising on their shows.
What point is Congress going to get involved in this as far as, like, inquiries and whatnot? I mean, because this is some serious stuff. We're talking about high crimes and
misdemeanors,
you know, of thousands and thousands of innocent people. This was, one of the worst things that I've seen.
I absolutely agree. Congress will get involved with this after the 2006 elections. We're talking to maybe 20 months from now. If. James, you and I and the others of us out there who are working on this are successful in getting Republicans thrown out of office and getting enough Democrats elected that we can take back the House and the Senate. In that case, George Bush will be held to account, I promise you. But if we're not successful in doing that, then you can expect this to continue to be stonewalled.
Well, I just hope democracy, continues, makes a stride forward and reclaims itself.
I agree.
Because right now, it's starting to look like... it's kind of a dictatorship, of choice that's running the country.
Yeah.
Which is under Republican control right now in the special interest. And it's really disheartening. You know, I work very hard for a living, and I'm sure most everybody else does. And, this last election, I didn't have a chance to go out and vote.
Yeah.
Because I was working so hard.
Well, and the Republicans want to keep it that way. They've been fighting every effort to make voting day a holiday and to make voting easier. It's anyhow, James, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you, and thank you for calling there in Wisconsin. Truck driver John in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, John.
Tom, I've been listening to you again today because I heard you're coming to our city. So you've
yes,
been on my mind.
I'll be there tomorrow. We're flying out as soon as I get off the air. In fact, we're running to the airport.
Yep. Well, anyway, I needed to call. I haven't listened to you for a long time, ever since you called James Dobbs and Osama bin Laden. That was it. That was all that broke the camel's back.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't think that he is Osama bin Laden?
No, I'm not even going to talk to you about this, Tom. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Really?
Absolutely ridiculous.
I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Well, listen, Tom.
We've adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
There's one problem. None of those guys killed anybody.
So?
Oh, so there's no difference. You
think that Osama bin Laden killed somebody?
I'm not even going to respond to that.
If you are advocating a policy, or if you are putting together a policy, you're getting people out there and promoting a policy, you're promoting hatred, and people act on that hatred, aren't you equally culpable?
Nobody has killed anybody as a result of the actions of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and I was talking about James Dobson. I know that you left him out.
Yeah.
But you called James Dobson our Osama bin Laden. But that's not what I called about.
Okay.
I called about this court thing.
All right.
And why wouldn't we blame liberals? It was all the liberals who voted for this thing.
I know. I'm mystified.
Yeah, oh, you're mystified.
I don't get it.
It's a government. It's a government grab. Why would you be mystified?
No, it's not a government grab. It's a corporate grab.
It's a government grab. The government did it for them.
Well, sure, I agree with you. I agree with you.
Who voted for it? Who voted for it? Those hated conservatives voted against it.
I know.
And your buddies voted for it.
Fuzzy
Ginsburg and.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And I can't. And I think it's wrong.
It's consistent.
No, it's. I don't think it's consistent. But whether it's consistent
it's
or not,
it's completely consistent.
I think it's wrong. I just think it's wrong. So yeah. You want to pick a fight with me about it? It's. I'm not. There's no fight here. You and I agree. Sorry to disappoint you.
For once.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Here we are. I have a higher calling in my mind than partisanship or left, right, or liberal or conservative. I'm really interested, frankly, in the truth. Believe it or not. Mike in Connecticut on the line. Hey, Mike. Thanks for calling. What's up?
How are you? I saw a poll, and I just kind of want to comment on it. It was not actually a poll. It was a study by the Quinnipiac people that put out the Quinnipiac poll. And the question was, has a non-candidate ever affected an election? And their hypothesis was possibly three times, one being Rush Limbaugh in the, I think it was the 96th congressional election.
Right.
The other was Pat Buchanan in 92 at the ridiculous speech he gave, cultural war and all that type of thing. And the third was possibly Michael Moore. And their theory is all it takes is 1 to 2% of voters to make a move to cause a, 2 to 4% swing that could change an election.
Yeah, I'll tell you another one, by the way. Father Coughlin, who had 30 to 40 million listeners, I mean, he was huge compared to, Limbaugh and these guys who on a good day may have 1 million to 2 million, something like that. Father Coughlin, Limbaugh's claiming 6. Father Coughlin, in 32, said Roosevelt or ruin, and he just repeated that like a mantra. Now, he turned on Roosevelt later on, of course, but I would say that Father Coughlin helped swing that election.
Possibility, but here's what...
Although Hoover was pretty unpopular, he didn't... Maybe Roosevelt didn't need Coughlin, I'm not sure.
There you go. But here's where I lead it to today, and here's what my concern is as a lifelong Democrat. My fear is, that last caller that you had, I am just outraged and appalled by some of the things that I am hearing on satellite radio, the left side of satellite radio. And my belief is, or my fear is, that satellite radio is going to be a standard feature in every car in a couple of years, and people are going to be listening to satellite radio like they're listening to terrestrial radio now. The things that I am hearing from the left as a Democrat scare the living hell out of me, because anyone that could be on the fence, any of those Blue Dog Democrats, the Reagan Democrats, the Iron Belt,
first of all, Mike, do you want to give me a specific?
Well, yeah, I'm going to tell you, with regards to the war, with regards to, the comments from the senator from Illinois.
Right.
I mean, I have heard comments, and you can't control your callers. Your callers are your callers. But here's some comments that I have heard from radio talk show hosts on the left-hand side. One being that one talk show person said that she believed that there was an equal chance that Dick Cheney was responsible for 9/11 as was Osama bin Laden.
Yeah. Mike, I'm sorry. I can't respond to what other talk show hosts are saying. I just can't. If you want to take me to task for something like the last caller did, that's fine. I'll stick up for myself, and if I think I'm wrong, I'll acknowledge it. But I just other talk show hosts, I'm sorry. I can't do it. Gloria in New Orleans. Hey, Gloria, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just kind of feel like we're like through the looking glass and down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, in so many ways. It's like up is down, left is right.
In so many ways, it's getting difficult to keep track. I feel like the carpenters are playing the conservatives against the liberals and vice versa. And with the very many of their assistants, and they're also using the religious right to hide behind. Case in point, with the 2004 election, all the fear about abortion and gay marriage. Right. Meanwhile, they continue to consolidate control in just all kinds of different ways.
Absolutely, Gloria. And speaking of up is down, here's George Bush. Just to give you 4 seconds of the rabbit hole.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
You get that? When we're talking about war, we're really talking about peace.
Exactly.
And,
this last Supreme Court ruling just plays right in with that.
Yeah.
It's like, what is going on?
Yeah, I'm really baffled. And as I said, now, of course, my opinion is at first blush. I just learned about this an hour ago. I haven't had a chance to read the ruling, which I intend to do. But my first take on it is that that this is something that is over the top. This is, you know, I agree with eminent domain that we have to have a way to build roads and schools.
Right.
But
we
don't have to have a way to build an office building. Private enterprise will find a way to build an office building.
I have heard and watched on C-SPAN in many different areas in the country and involving, the large box department stores, the Walmart type entities and that kind of thing. So.
Oh yeah, and this goes back to, I mean, on the government level, this goes back to urban renewal about tearing down slums and building, you know, that kind of thing, and disenfranchising. And historically, the people who've been disenfranchised have been people of color or people who didn't have economic or political power. And now this was a working class community in New London, Connecticut.
Yeah, I was trying to say that it made it to the Supreme Court, but.
Number one, it's kind of a sad commentary on the state of affairs in America that it takes that to get it to the Supreme Court. But number two, you know, exactly. Look what happened. I got to say, Gloria, thank you for your call, by the way.
Yeah, we're all mystified.
Exactly. Here we are. We're absolutely mystified. What's going on? This is one that I would have expected frankly, I wouldn't have expected it to pass. Color me confused. Marshall in Virginia. Hey, Marshall, what's up?
Hey, nothing much, Tom. You gotta say I absolutely love your show. You're the best one in all series.
Thank you.
I was just thinking, you know, after, you know, I watched a South Park episode on the Passion of the Christ, and I was just thinking, you know, maybe you can, I don't know if this is more of a comment, but, I mean, I think that, honestly, that probably brought as many voters to the right side of the table as Fahrenheit 9/11 might have brought to the left side of the table.
Well, I didn't see it, so I can't comment on it, Marshall. I'm sorry.
Neither did I, but I mean, you know, the South Park's generally been pretty.
Oh, you're talking about the movie, The Passion of the Christ, brought people to the right side.
Not the episode of South Park, but the movie of the Christ.
Yeah. I didn't see that movie either. So, but you know, I know that Bill O'Reilly was pumping it like crazy because he owned a piece of it. He was one of the investors in it, and so he was hyping it like crazy on Fox. And of course, that got the spin going, and it turned into a phenomena. Certainly did make a lot of money for what's his name. Good old Mad Max, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The other thing is, you know, Dobson is probably one of the more evil people in this country. And, you know, the sad thing is that I honestly think that Osama bin Laden didn't attack you and me. I think he attacked people like him. And for them to come out and start blaming on all the other people.
Yeah, well, I think that Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks on 9/11. You know, I'll buy that. But that's religious intolerance. When religiously intolerant and hateful people try to insert themselves into politics and tell people how they should be conducting themselves politically, my antenna go up. But that's not a good thing in my mind. Charles in Ohio on the line. Hey, Charles, what's up?
I'm doing pretty good. I was going to call you to ask, too, for putting Dobson in there with Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden is far more flexible than Dobson has ever been.
Oh, yeah? So, why do you say that?
Well, let's face it. I mean, his entire thing has been very inflexible ever since he started it up out in Kansas. I mean, he's been homophobic. It's actually been rather downright racist in many cases.
But how has Osama bin Laden? How has bin Laden been more flexible?
If you're willing to convert to Wahhabism, he's much more willing to let you try to convert to Wahhabism than he is to sit out there and And so long as you stay out of his holy land, he's not going to do anything to you anyway.
Yeah, well, and the fact of the matter is that back in the 90s, he told us that if we didn't get our American troops out of Saudi Arabia, he was going to attack us, and that was the basis, you know, ultimately for 9/11. And George W. Bush last year actually, or the year before last, actually did take our troops out of Saudi Arabia. So, you know, maybe he's getting what he wants. I mean, it seemed to me for a long time that bin Laden was getting exactly what he wanted. George Bush was making him into a hero for the Muslim world, which is a tragedy for all of us. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Thanks for the call, by the way, Charles. Good to hear from you. I'm Tom Hartman with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The billionaires for Bush and Cheney. Yes, welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, toll free nationwide. And Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I will be tomorrow at Celebration Cinema doing the program live. You're welcome to show up. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Yeah, hey. I was kind of flipping channels, watching TV this morning,
uh-huh,
and happened to catch the Senate Finance Committee, Alan Greenspan and the chair, Lawrence Summers, whatever his office is, the monetary guy,
mm-hmm, yeah,
for the administration. Anyway, you know, they were going back and forth, and you know why they can't seem to get a handle on, you know, the nation's finances, economics, and whatnot. And this is the one thing that I think Republicans should really, like, start paying attention to. You know, they always worrying about these little, you know, non-issues, abortion, gay marriage.
Well, that's because they don't want us to pay attention to the big issues, because they're looting our country.
Right. And this goes to the heart of all the issues here, is what price, you know, is democracy? You know, what price is this administration? I mean, you know, if you pay a certain amount, you know, you can get some play. You can get in. You can get your voice heard.
Oh, these guys have bankrupted us, and the corruption goes way beyond that, Jason. I mean, the thing that really concerns me is we've got now communist China, a communist dictatorship that is, you know, seeking to rule the world. You want to talk about empire? And they're coming in, and they want to buy Unocal. They just bought Maytag for $1.3 billion.
Right.
They're in the Wall Street Journal today. They're saying basically anything that has manufacturing, the Chinese want to buy it. Now, how did the Chinese get all those dollars so that they could come in here and buy America? In fact, how did we end up with a situation where we owed them so much that they could come in and just cash in their IOUs? Because of insane trade policies that started with Ronald Reagan that have sold this country down the tubes. We're running a $600 billion your trade deficit. That means that every year $600 billion of American industry, American land, America homes has to be sold off to some foreign country so that we can borrow the money from them or get the money from them so that we can buy goods from them that they make so that they, and lacking our jobs. Now, they can make with their laborers instead of our laborers.
Right. And I was just going to mention that, but it's getting to the point where if everything is for sale, then you know, we won't even own this country anymore.
Well, increasingly, absolutely.
The voting pattern that have allowed this to happen, people voting.
It's just absolutely wrong. Jason, I'm sorry we're out of time, but it's just absolutely wrong. We got to do something about it. We got to do it in the ballot box. And increasingly, it's looking like the Republicans are never going to fix this, and a lot of the Democrats aren't if we don't hold them accountable. You and I need to get active. We need to get politically active. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here for the second hour of our program. So glad to be with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com, our website. If you'd like to drop by, drop into the live chat, or you can drop by the blog and message board area and participate in conversation. Apparently nobody saw Rollerball and Balio, the discussion in the chat room right now. This is a lot in the news today, a lot of really, I think, really hot and important things. I think the biggest and most concerning is probably the one that's going to get the least coverage in the mainstream media. It's not the screaming thing, and that is that the Chinese are on a buying spree. They are buying up the United States of America. And at what point? Well, you know, the larger question is, at what point do you say no? Many companies have laws that say you can buy parts of a company in our country, but not all of one. For example, back in the 1970s, a good friend of mine in New York, Jerry Schneiderman, Jerry and I owned a business together called Langley St. Clair Instrumentation Systems that was selling through Byte Magazine, through ads in Byte Magazine, the computer magazine. It was selling computer parts. And this was back when people were building their own computers. This was in TRS-80 days, right? And we were importing a lot of these things in Japan. And so I'd go over to Japan and negotiate with these companies, and we would buy the things that weren't made here in the United States. Anti-radiation screen shield, for example. We were also selling things that were made in the United States. We were selling low-radiation picture tubes that were made by a company down in Atlanta, Georgia, and so on. But in any case, you know, it was business. And one of the things I learned when I went over to Japan was that if we wanted to invest in a company, if we wanted to buy a company, now we didn't have the means to do it. We were a small, you know, basically a two-person mail order business. But if we had wanted to do this and get into this, we could not buy more than 49% of a company. Because at that time, now I don't know, it might have changed since then, although I'd be surprised to find that it has. But at that time in the 1970s in Japan, nobody who was not Japanese, not a Japanese citizen, could own more than 49% of any Japanese company. In other words, a Japanese company was a Japanese company. And many countries around the world have these kinds of laws to protect their domestic industries. Now, historically in the United States, we have not had those kind of laws. The way we have protected our domestic industries is by having a strong economy. We have said, you know, we have been the creditors to the world. We, rather than going in debt to the world, we have had the world owe us money. In the late 1970s, when Jimmy Carter was president, before Ronald Reagan came into office, the United States was the world's largest creditor. More countries owed us money than any other country in the world. And as a result of that, because we had all these IOUs that other countries owed us because they had trade imbalances with us, we were able to go to those countries and say, you know, I think we'll buy this company here in the Philippines, and we'll buy this company here in Holland, and we'll buy this company here in Nigeria, and we'll buy this company here in Saudi Arabia, or whatever, in those countries where it could be done. And you had American outposts all over the world. We'll buy this land in Nicaragua for a banana plantation, and we'll buy this, you know, land in Hawaii for Dole pineapple, whatever. I mean, we had the ability to do that. Now, you can argue the wisdom of that. You can argue the morality of that. You know, it was empire by economics, but we had the ability to do that. And it defended us from being bought up ourselves. And we have lost that now since Reaganomics has, you know, 25 years of Reaganomics, trickle-down economics, and insane trade policies. After 200 years of building a strong and vital nation and one of the strongest and most vibrant middle classes the world has ever seen, 25 years of Reaganomics has nearly destroyed this country, and now the Chinese are coming in to buy up the remnants. And it's wrong. It's just wrong. And I'm not suggesting that we should pass, you know, the equivalent of domestic content laws. I'm not saying that we should pass a law saying, hey, nobody from any other country can buy a company or more than 49% of a company in the United States. I'm not sure I would oppose that, but that's not the solution. The solution is for us to stop having trade deficits. Because the trade deficits are what allow other countries, in fact, it virtually require other countries to come over here to the United States and buy up either our land. A lot of people don't realize their homes, their mortgages are actually owned by offshore companies. You got, you know, one of the largest banks in the United States is owned by the Saudis. A lot of people don't realize that their credit card, that they're actually in debt to foreigners. Why? Because we create these trade deficits. We're buying all that oil from Saudi Arabia. We're buying all that junk from China to sell in Walmart stores. And we're not selling equivalent amounts of stuff back to them. So with that money, they come to us and they say, okay, we got all this money of yours, all these dollars. We can't spend them in our country. They're pretty worthless here. We'll buy you. And suddenly American workers are no longer working for American companies. And people, and then the cons come along, and this is what they say. This is you will hear this, and by cons, you will hear Democrats saying this, as well as the Republicans. It's a mantra. You will hear them say, well, the Japanese companies that are coming over here, for example, the most common example, you know, this is Tom Friedman, right? The Lexus tree and the olive, or the Lexus and the olive tree, excuse me. This is Tom Friedman. This is the conservative mantra. Well, the Toyota is actually hiring Americans. They're insourcing jobs. Isn't that a wonderful thing? You've got foreign companies coming over here to the United States to build car factories. Isn't that great? Americans have jobs, and they're good-paying jobs. In many cases, they're even union jobs. My response? If Americans want to buy cars, I would rather the Americans bought cars from companies who are paying their profits to America. To Americans. Because... yes, Toyota, you know, God bless them. Who am I to criticize Toyota? I drive a Toyota. I drive a Toyota Prius. But the reality is that Toyota, if Toyota makes a car in the United States, where does that profit go? It goes back to Japan. And it's not a wise thing for our economy. It's not an intelligent policy. To have a situation, a national policy, where we are encouraging, in fact, we are essentially forcing foreign companies, foreign nations, representatives of foreign nations to come over to the United States and buy up our land to build factories, to employ us. Gee, isn't that nice? They're going to give us a job, and they're going to make $1 billion, and they're going to take it home with them. And part of the reason why Americans don't freak out when conservatives say, oh, but isn't it a great thing? They're giving us jobs. It's because 40 years ago, everybody in America understood that nobody gives you a job. That employers employ people because they can make more money off that person's labor than that person's labor costs. A business that pays somebody $10 an hour better be making $11 an hour off that person's work. And in fact, there are ratios in business that you look at. You know, in the travel industry, I remember we used to own a travel business in Atlanta. It was either like 10 to 1 or 50 to 1, something like that. In other words, if you're paying somebody $10 an hour, they better be able to produce $1,000 an hour worth of sales. If they can't, you can't make money. And so it's not, nobody's giving people jobs. Workers are giving their labor. They're giving their time, they're giving part of their lives, they're giving their life energy to an employer in exchange for a paycheck, and the employer is taking that life energy, that labor, and converting it into something that has more value than the money that they're paying the laborer. It's very simple. And so everybody in America understood this before we've had, you know, 15, 20 years now of right-wing indoctrination on the radio, on the airwaves of this country and the Heritage Foundation and everybody else, you know, cranking this stuff out. 40 years ago in America, if you had said, or even 30 years ago in America, if you had said, oh, isn't it wonderful, Toyota's coming over here, they're giving us jobs, people would have said, no, wait a minute, they're taking their profits out of the country because they're not giving us jobs, they're giving us an opportunity to help them make money. And this is not, as I said, not to pick on Toyota. This isn't the fault of any particular corporation or country. This is the fault of politicians in the United States who have sold out our country. Starting with Ronald Reagan, going through George Herbert Walker Bush, including Bill Clinton, and up to George W. Bush right now. Who have sold out our country with insane trade policies. I'm starting to sound like Jerry Falwell here, aren't I? I point my finger at you and say, you did this. Oh, my. Linda, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hello?
Hey, Linda, you're live and on the air.
Oh, sorry. Do you think that we could put John Paul Stevens and Robert Mugabe on the ticket in 2008?
I don't get it. John Paul Stevens, the Supreme Court Justice, and Robert Mugabe, the President of Zimbabwe?
Yeah, he was taking everybody's homes away.
Oh, I get it now. Yeah, okay.
Seriously, yeah. Can you, a request, can you play some Woody Guthrie music?
I'll have to pass that along to Louise. She does the bumpers here, so,
I don't
control the music.
Okay.
I just get to comment on it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Linda, for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Tomas in Grand Rapids. Hey, Tomas.
Listen, I got a treat for you, man, since you're coming over to my sweet city tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
I have a little poem for you. It's real short, okay? Here we go. Tom Hartman, you're coming here tomorrow, visiting this bastion of mega dittos. Tom Hartman's on the left, I'm on the right. He's pro-choice, and I'm pro-life. So in honor of your visit to the part of Michigan you love the most, tomorrow I'm bringing you French fries, French toast, and French roast. If you say you drive a Toyota, I drive a Dodge van that's full size. But remember,
good
Tom,
on you.
When we drive on the right-hand side.
Okay, good on you, Tomas. And so you and I both actually own foreign cars, don't we?
What do you mean, baby?
Isn't Dodge made by Chrysler, which is owned by right. Mercedes-Benz?
Well, all right.
So you got a German car, I got a Japanese car.
That hurt me, man. That hurt me. I did a nice poem for you, and you smacked me down like
that. You're right. You're right. I'm sorry. That was a nice poem, Tomas. I appreciate it. I appreciate it. You're a good man.
Hey, man.
And
hey,
I hope you can show up tomorrow.
I'll try and be there, bro.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Hey, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Tomas, who always likes to spar with me. It's our ongoing debate. Ananya in Toronto on the line. Hey, Ananya.
I was fine.
Yeah, we only have about 30 seconds here. If this is going to be a little longer thing, well, what's up? What's in
your
mind?
Okay, your views on China and people coming and buying up Americans.
Yes.
I agree with your position, but I think you need to also tell the other half of the story as to how American multinationals, British multinationals are doing, have been doing the same for millennia.
Yeah, that's what I said. Historically, that's been what, you know, America has done, and I'm not saying that that's a good or moral thing. And in fact, it's been an aspect of empire that has not served us well, I think, in many ways. My suggestion is that it should be neutral, that we should, you know, that we should be, you know, within our borders. We should be following George Washington's advice and avoid foreign entanglements. But you're absolutely right. And folks in Canada have a lot of legitimate grievances against Americans coming in and buying up their country and their companies. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Yes, never going back again to that Reaganomics, that trickle-down economics, those insane political theories. I'm sorry, just ain't going to go there, ain't going to do that. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, our report for the day from Washington, D.C. What's going on deep in the belly of the beast, Victoria?
Fascinating. I've spent the entire morning in the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing with Secretary Rumsfeld and then Generals Abizade, Myers, and Casey. It's coming to an end, and I expect some of them to be available to the press shortly. It's been fascinating to hear the questions from both sides of the aisle, with very few exceptions. The questions have been tough. A lot of concern about what's going on in Iraq. And one senator in particular who spoke really very, very much towards the end, Senator Byrd, said some things that it's not quite verbatim, but let me tell you a little bit of what he said. He said he has never seen a Secretary of Defense who likes to lecture the committee as much as Rumsfeld does.
Yeah, and he's been around a long time, Mr. Byrd.
Right. He went on to say, nobody questions the ability of our soldiers. Now, everybody, all the witnesses have been basically trying to say that we have the best military in the world, like anyone was questioning that. He said, you're pretty feisty. I like that. But we're trying to represent the people. I can't refute a sneer, and we get that when you come up. You may not like our questions, but we represent the people. I've had my fill of the administration forgetting that this is a constitutional system. There are three separate equal branches of government. We didn't ask enough questions at the beginning of Mr. Bush's war. My time's up, but I've been waiting a while. And so he went on, men and women out there are dying, and their relatives are asking questions. I'm ashamed of my great body that didn't ask enough. The American people haven't been told enough of the truth. Forgive me for appearing discourteous. I've heard enough of your smart answers. Get off your high horse when you come here.
This is Robert Byrd?
Election. You don't. Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he went on to ask, his question in the end basically was about what is the war going to cost?
Yeah. And the answer was?
Well, the answer was basically that they did try to budget at the beginning, but Rumsfeld tried to put it back on Congress to say that he believed that they always ran war with supplementals. The answer is
how much you got.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Are you hearing any fallout from the Supreme Court decision this morning that on behalf of private corporations, cities, states, municipalities can move to take private property?
Well, I've literally walked out of the committee and come straight to you, so I've heard nothing so far. But the only thing I can say is that a lot of members of the press were hoping for some kind of ruling on whether journalists will be going to prison for not revealing their sources, and are disappointed that they haven't heard that today.
Yeah, that hasn't, to the best of my knowledge, that didn't come down. But this one on private property is a big deal. So, Mr. Rumsfeld trying to rationalize the war. Did anybody ask any variation on my question of if the proof that we are succeeding, that we are winning, is that more and more Americans are dying, and there are more and more suicide attacks, that shows that they're desperate, that means that we're winning, then how do we know, if we have a metric for how we know when we're winning, what's the metric for how we know when we're losing? How do we know when we're losing?
Well, it wasn't asked in quite that way, but questions were asked about how will we know when we've won. In fact, I think it might have been Senator Reid, I'm not sure, who said, how are we actually going to know when we've won? What are the benchmarks? So he was given a list of benchmarks. By the way, Rumsfeld was attacked by Kennedy, who gave us a distributed list of Rumsfeld's quotes before the war and in the war, four pages of them on different subjects, all of which Kennedy said were wrong, and he went after him on those grounds.
Oh, interesting. And how did Rumsfeld respond?
He basically talked about taking things out of context.
Oh, so he basically snarled at him or something?
He snarled. Hillary started off very sort of conciliatory, and she quoted to Rumsfeld a statement from, I think, Today's Post, which refers to, running out of time.
Yeah. Well, you got another 10 seconds if you want.
She quoted Rove at him and said it wasn't helpful what Rove was saying, and it's time to stop.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria, for your report.
Thank you very much. Thank you so
much appreciated. The Talk Radio News Service there in Washington, D.C. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's a hard knock life.
Yeah.
Hard knock. It's a hard knock life.
Stick that in your pipe and smoke it. For all my hoodies.
A hard luck life. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman program. 25 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, the website URL, TomHartman.com, will get you there. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky is with us. Hey, great to have you here.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here, Tom.
You have been an outspoken. First of all, just for our listeners who don't know, you were elected to represent the Illinois 9th Congressional District back in 1998 after serving 8 years in the Illinois State Assembly. And you have been standing up for Dick Durbin, which I want to salute you for.
Thank you.
And I have been standing up for Dick Durbin, and I was disappointed isn't quite the word, because I understood the kind of enormous pressure that the right-wing media can bring on somebody when they want to blow something out of proportion to him. But I was something like disappointed when he apologized, because I thought that he was raising really good issues, and what the right wing did was they made him the issue rather than the treatment of our prisoners. But rather than my
Absolutely.
Pontificating, let me give you an opportunity to speak.
Well, you know, this is a strategy of the Republicans right now, that anybody who's a critic of their policies, and everybody knew what Dick Durbin meant, and he was right, that it is simply un-American what's happening at Guantanamo Bay, where nobody's charged with anything, where there are clearly tactics that you could characterize as torture being undertaken there, as well as in Abu Ghraib. I understand there's going to be more photos that are coming out that shame the United States. This is un-American. That's really what he was saying, that we are better than that. But no, they want to shoot the messenger. They want to just trash the any critic of what they do. And you know what? It was Dick Durbin this week. It's going to be somebody else. They go after Nancy Pelosi. They go after Howard Dean. That's what they do. Rather than answer the substance, they go after, in a personal way, the critics of their policies.
Well, this is the thing that really confuses me. Jeff Sessions, the Republican from Alabama, on October 11th of last year, referred to people who were working in the stem cell field as Nazis. You know?
Oh, it's every day on the House floor. I'm not kidding.
Yeah,
every day, you know?
And the Republicans are constantly doing this. I mean, if Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma, he said, in fact, there was the headline on KTOK News in Oklahoma City, Cole claims a vote against Bush is a vote for Hitler. This was, you know, he says, you know, re-election of George Bush is like, if you work against George Bush, it's like supporting Adolf Hitler during World War II.
You know, and asking for an apology. Come on, where's the apology that they sent our young men and women into war over lies? How about an apology for undermining American values in Guantanamo, like not upholding the rule of law? Or how about putting our troops at risk without having up-armored vehicles or the proper body armor, or, you know, cutting health benefits for veterans? You know, they want to start talking about apologies. I'm ready.
Yeah, well, I'm curious, Representative Schakowsky, how have you been able to deal with the right wingers who come after you? I mean, Dick Durbin folded basically.
You know, I'll tell you what, I say bring them on, because it's another opportunity to talk about their failures. You know, and I'm certain Dick Durbin, I was out there defending him. He's one of my very best friends in life, as well as in the Congress. And I understand that, you know, he wanted to clarify what he meant, and he was hurt. He was hurt by the allegations that somehow he was demeaning our troops. What I'm hoping to do is to keep our eyes on the prize, and that's being on the offensive here, because if anybody owes an explanation to the American people over the war in Iraq, over why they're cutting on all the programs that people care about right now, as we speak, the labor and health and human services budget, education, health care, all these are being cut.
Oh, but those are socialist programs, Congressman.
You know what? Even the President of the United States said he's very concerned. He's worried about, you know, people being able to make it and about their values and the importance of education. But meantime, cutting those programs.
Right. These guys, they give the rhetoric.
Oh yeah,
they've really learned how to do how to talk the talk, but when it comes to walking the walk, it's the exact opposite. It's the hypocrisy is stunning, is absolutely stunning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think that in 2006 it seems to me that there's just this incredible awakening happening across America right now?
I feel it too.
Do you think in 2006 that the Democrats can take back the House and the Senate?
Well, let me tell you, the largest growing category of incumbent Republicans right now is those who are ethically challenged. And believe me, we're taking note of all of those and doing a major job of recruitment around the country. If the election were held today, I absolutely do think that Democrats would be in the majority, because the view of the Congress right now, the ratings of the are absolutely at the lowest, and well, they should be. We're, you know, Americans are saying the Congress and the President don't share their priorities, and I see that every single day on the floor of the House. We're dealing with things that have nothing to do with the lives of ordinary people, you know. And so I am very optimistic that, you know, we're giving them a little extra rope right now. They're hanging themselves, and I think that in 2006, people are ready to take back their country. They want to see a new direction. They want to see their priorities of and their values really being dealt with.
Mm, yeah, I agree. Now, I know you have to go. One final question here, mm-hmm. though, if you don't mind.
Sure.
When we look at the Downing Street memo and we look at the timeline and we look at the interviews that were done with George W. Bush in 1999 by his biographer, when Bush told his biographer, the fellow who is writing, ghostwriting A Charge to Keep, that his father had made a mistake by not using the political capital of the war, and he said, if I have an opportunity to invade Iraq, I will use that political capital to get done everything I want to get done, so I will have a successful presidency, not a failed presidency like my father. I'm paraphrasing, but that's mm-hmm. pretty close mm-hmm. to exactly mm-hmm. what he said. It makes it quite clear that Paul O'Neill was right, that Bush was focused on invading Iraq literally from the day he was inaugurated, and that he lied us into this war, that there was a whole series of lies to the American people and to Congress to create this war, and that the reason that he lied us into the war wasn't to get oil and wasn't to revenge his father, but it was to get political capital. In other words, so the Republicans could mm-hmm. take the Senate in 2002 and Bush could get reelected in 2004. If that's the case, And it certainly seems like it may be, and I realize that this is kind of a setup question because there's a presumption in it. But nonetheless, if that's even possible, possibly the case, could it be that they're planning another war to get more political capital before 2006, for example, in Syria or Iran? And if so, are you seeing any indications of that?
Yeah.
And if so, how is Congress going to respond?
I hear the question. I want to answer in a couple ways. First of all, I think they might, if they could. But because they have so depleted the resources of our military right now, I think the possibility not only of engaging themselves in another war, but even responding to an emergency. I'm talking North Korea or Iran is severely compromised right now. And so I don't think they can. But, you know, there was an editorial in the Boston Globe a couple of days ago saying that not only did they manufacture the excuses to go to war, the Downing Street memo, but effectively began the war, something I really mm-hmm. wasn't all that aware of.
Yeah, doubling the bombing, yeah, back in 2002.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, something that never was really discussed at any length on the floor of the House or, quite frankly, even really widely known, the extent to which we were engaged in war in Iraq. The war in Iraq is just one of the many things that fell under the cloud of 9/11, where 9/11 provided the excuse for something that they have wanted to do for a very long time. Yeah. That's the secrecy of their government, that's some of the provisions of the Patriot Act, and most importantly, I think that is the invasion and occupation of Iraq, which, you know, I don't know if they would do it again, seeing how badly it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I've stopped calling it a war. I refer to it as the invasion and occupation because that's really what it is. They didn't attack us. It's not a war. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, thanks so much for being with
us
today.
Thanks, Tom.
You're doing a great job. Keep
it
up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And a marvelous job of representing the Illinois 9th Congressional District.
Thanks.
Thank you for being with us.
Bye.
It's the Tom Hartman Program. It's 17 minutes before the hour. And, wow, isn't it a breath of fresh air to find members of Congress who actually get it, who have figured out what's going on and are willing to talk about it. And they're in Illinois. I mean, it's just, I'm so pleased. State Representative Henry Joy of Maine is spearheading legislation on climate change policy. Now, this just to take this to the next step, this is the flip side of what Jan Schakowsky is talking about. The conservatives are so well organized that I think, frankly, most people don't realize how well organized they are. There is an organization out there called ALEC, A-L-E-C, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And what I was reading to you just a second ago was from one of their press releases. The American Legislative Exchange Council today congratulated State Representative Henry Joy of Maine. This is a conservative
for spearheading legislation on climate change policy that was signed into law by Governor John Bel Daci last week. The new law would provide an important check and balance on Maine's climate change policy by requiring that the legislature consider the cost effectiveness of the state's actions. In other words, any legislation that has to do with the environment has to first be run by industry for their approval. I mean, that's essentially the bottom line. Now, who is ALEC? What is this organization that is able to, that has had the ability, apparently, to get legislation passed? Well, it's really quite remarkable when you look at it. ALEC, the mission statement of the organization is to promote the principles of federalism by developing and promoting policies that reflect the Jeffersonian principles that the powers of government are derived from and assigned to first the people, then the states, and finally the national government. End of quote. To achieve this, it aims to, quote, enlist state legislators from all parties and members of the private sector who share ALEC's mission, end quote. Now, when ALEC began, this according to ALEC, it comprised only a handful, actually not according to them, excuse me. This is from another source. And when ALEC began, it comprised only a handful of right-wing legislators. By 1991, it had grown into a clearinghouse of information for 2,400 conservative office holders in 50 states, almost one-third of the 7,500 state legislators in the country. Almost a third of all the state representatives and state senators in the United States. According to a representative of the National Council of State Legislatures, although ALEC has not substantially modified its right-wing position on what it considers to be core issues, it has been successful in attracting more moderate legislative support by toning down its more extreme rhetoric. For example, William Bennett, Jack Kemp, John Sununu, and George Bush have all addressed ALEC sessions in recent years. I'm sorry, those guys in my mind are all extremists. This is information from the National Resource Defense Council. They argue that ALEC plays a central role in reversing environmental legislation all across the country. Quote, ALEC is the corporate-funded pivotal point where this network, ranging from national organizations like the Heritage Foundation to state-based think tanks that comprise the state policy networks, connect. ALEC, which is in part funded by ExxonMobil, opposes any U.S. action to implement the Kyoto Treaty on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Sandy Liddy Bourne, ALEC's Environmental National Resource Director, Natural Resources and Agriculture Task Force Director, says, quote, states should reject every form of Kyoto legislation for the very same reason as our leaders in Washington, D.C. In a May 2004 ALEC forum, industry groups proposed a biotechnology state uniformity resolution that would, in effect, disallow communities from passing resolutions against genetically engineered seeds, crops, or animals. This from counterpunch.org, by the way. Within a year's time, assisted by state Farm Bureau chapters and pro-industrial agricultural state legislator, 15 states introduced legislation to remove local control of plants and seeds. 11 already passed into law. These guys are changing the laws state by state, moving across the United States, changing the laws state by state, methodically, providing much, if not most, of the information to at least a third of the state legislators all across the United States. The board of directors, Kurt L. Malmgren of Pharma, the chairman, Pharma, the big trade group for the drug industry, Scott Fisher, the second vice chairman, he's with Altria Corporate Services, that's the big tobacco company, used to be called Philip Morris, Pete Poynter, Bell South Corporation, he's their treasurer, Michael Morgan, immediate past chairman of Koch Industries, the big oil company in Texas. Alan Auger, the chairman emeritus, Coors Brewing Company. Ronald F. Sherbley is the chairman emeritus of Verizon Communications. This is their board of directors. Their sponsors. In the alcohol field, Coors, Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, Joseph Miller Brewing Company, Joseph Seagram. In automotive, Avis, Daimler Chrysler, Ford Motor Company, General Motors. In banking, American Express, Bank of America, America General Financial Group, Credit Card Coalition, Fidelity Investments, Harris Trust, Household International, J.P. Morgan and Company, LaSalle National Bank, in criminal justice, the American Bail Corporation, Corrections Corporation of America, that's one of the largest private prison owners in the United States, National Association of Bail Insurance Companies, Wackenhut, this is the second largest of private prison runners. This is pretty startling stuff. Energy producers, the American Petroleum Institute, Amoco Corporation, ARCO, BP America, Caltex Petroleum, Chevron, ExxonMobil, Mobil Oil, Phillips Petroleum. Other energy producers, the American Gas Association, Consolidated Edison, Enron Corporation, Koch Industries, Mid-American Energy, PG&E Corporation, U.S. Generating. In insurance, the Alliance of American Insurance. I mean, this is a who's who of American industry is behind this thing. We haven't even gotten up to pharmaceuticals, right? Abbott, Aventis, Bayer, Eli Lilly, GlaxoSmithKline, Hoffman, LaRoche, Merck, Wyeth, McDonald's, Wendy's, America Online. And they're telling our legislators at the state level, all across America, what to do. 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Alice in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
The real problem, Tom, is that we in America have a government that doesn't care about us, the people. Not even a little bit.
Yeah, they certainly attend to their corporate taskmasters.
We got these people through deception and through election fraud, and they are planning to stay in office the same way. More fraud, more lies.
Yeah, I agree with you, Alice. It's a sad thing, sad commentary. Alice, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Okay.
Good to hear from you. Tom in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was listening to Paul Harvey this morning, and boy, is he going over the deep end.
Oh, yeah?
He was talking about taking the atomic bombs out of the moth bags and dropping them in Afghanistan and Iraq to end this war like you did during the bombing of Pearl Harbor. He doesn't stop to realize there was no nation involved in the bombing of the towers, but he sure makes it sound like it was.
You're kidding. Paul Harvey thinks that Iraq had something to do with 9/11?
Yeah,
or that Afghanistan did?
Yeah, well, he blended all it in together so that, you know, that we should drop atomic bombs to stop all the killing. You know, like the war ended after World War II after the bombs were dropped.
Oh, my.
You know, so he's really out there now.
Oh, my. That's so sad. And, That's so sad to hear.
Yeah, and in the old days, you used to hear Hail Caesar. Now it's Hail Corporations.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd say Viva Howard Dean.
There you go. Okay, thanks a lot, Tom. Good to hear from you. Michelle in Long Beach, California. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Tom. Listen, you made me do a ALAC.
Uh-huh.
And then it took
A-L-E-C.
Me... Oh, well, that's funny. Because...
It's the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Oh, well, I put in ALAC, and you should see what I got on ICANN. Have you heard of ICANN?
Carl ICANN?
No, it's ICANN, and it's
oh, yeah.
They watchers of the internet.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The company that holds the numbers that translate into everybody's URLs. Yeah. That's a whole other issue. That's a whole other can of worms.
I'm sorry, because it was like I did this Google after, so it's ALEC.
That's right, American Legislative Exchange Council. It's one of these organizations that has very successfully flown under the radar for 3 decades. And they have enormous power, just like the Federalist Society with the judges in law schools.
I
got to move along, Michelle. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I appreciate your call. It's great to hear from you. Thanks for being with us today. And, of course, we've got another hour of the program, but we will be back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People.
You've been been listening to the Tom Hartman Program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yesterday, Louise comes and she says, our grandchildren are on the back deck. And I'm like, what? It's something I didn't know about. Go down and look out. There's our goose, Gusellini, the goose who had taken over our back deck. We couldn't figure out. We called him Gusellini because we thought he was some kind of nutcase. I mean, for 4 or 5 months, he was sitting out there, wouldn't let anybody, any other geese, get near. And then suddenly another goose showed up along with a little gosling, a little baby. And he had been protecting the mother goose and the egg who were in the house next door, apparently. And now, and they've somehow acquired another gosling, apparently. When one of these guys hatches out of the eggs, whoever they see is, they think, ah, that's mom, and or dad or whatever, and they go following them, and so anyhow, Gusellini and his significant other, and I can't tell the gender on geese, I don't know, but anyhow, Gusellini, his partner, and their egg, and their, excuse me, and their two now goslings. We're camped out on our back deck, and it was sweet. So, our I don't want to call them pets, because they probably think we're the pets because we feed them. Hey, look at those humans. Let's make them toss some more oatmeal out here, or cracked corn. Yes, that would be nice, a little cracked corn. Anyhow, speaking of cracked corn, the Republican talking points. You know, Frank Luntz, a month or so ago, did some very intense focus group work and discovered that the word obstructionist still has a lot of juice. It worked fairly effectively for the Democrats. It worked fairly effectively for Bill Clinton to label the Newt Gingrich, you know, Republicans as obstructionists. And so they pulled that word out and focus grouped it and tested it and found that even Democrats, I'm guessing that they found that even Democrats respond negatively to it. It's a, you know, nobody wants to be called an obstructionist, right? We all want to be called, you know, people who are, you know, accomplishing some goal, you know, doing something worthwhile. So they started, you know, so now the word du jour coming out of the Bush White House and the Republican Party is going to be obstructionists or obstruction. I guarantee you can expect to hear it a lot. And so I thought it might be useful to look at who the real obstructionists are. I mean, you know, after all, who are the real obstruction? Who are those? Who is, you know, this is sort of a variation on that. Who is that masked man? Who are the real obstructionists? And over at Think Progress, the blog for the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org, they put together a nice little summary of the real obstructionists. Who obstructed pre-war intelligence? Who fixed the pre-war intelligence? Who was obstructing rational intelligence from reaching the media, the military, the highest branches of government, certainly Congress? Well, it was the Republicans in the Bush White House. Who is obstructing an investigation into the stovepiping of that intelligence, all of those trips that Dick Cheney made down to the CIA, Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld setting up his own private office with Doug Feith, the Office of Special Plans inside the Defense Department to conduct their own intelligence assessments. Who's obstructing the investigation into the fixing of pre-war intelligence? Well, the Bush White House. Specifically, Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Pat Roberts, senator from Kansas, has blocked any planned examination of the administration's role in shaping pre-war intelligence. Why? He says it would be a monumental waste of time. Pat Roberts, Republican of Kansas, says to look into the administration's role in shaping pre-war intelligence would be a monumental waste of time. By the way, if you think that Pat Roberts might be wrong, then, you know, you can call 1-877-SOB-USOB. Yes, SOB, the letter U, SOB, 1-877. It's toll free. It's toll free call, 1-877-SOB-USOB, and ask for the office of Senator Pat Roberts and tell him what you think. Please be polite. I would say, if I were calling, please tell Senator Roberts that I think that an investigation of the Bush administration's shaping, fixing intelligence not only would not be a monumental waste of time, but would be probably some of the best time that could be served by the United States Senate. In any case, Pat Roberts leading the obstructionist Republicans in the Senate. The 9/11 Commission apparently being obstructed by National Intelligence Director John Negroponte. They regrouped early this month out of fear that the Bush administration and Congress will never act on some of their recommendations. The administration blocking 9/11 Commission reforms, obstruction. The Ethics Committee in the House of Representatives obstructed from operating. It's been paralyzed by conservatives for the second time this year, thanks to a conflict over staff hiring initiated by Chairman Congressman Doc Hastings of Washington State, former Jack Abramoff associate. The Republicans obstructing any explicit development of an exit strategy from Iraq. You'd think, you know, they'd like to. I mean, we would like to know, how do we get out of there? Should we do like Paul Harvey said, just drop a nuclear bomb on a country that never even attacked us, never even threatened us? A country that threw open its doors to the weapons inspectors, said, come on in, look around? A country that gave us 14,000 pages of documents proving that they destroyed all their weapons? Should we just drop a nuclear bomb on them and all their 30-some-odd million civilians? Actually, I shouldn't say Paul Harvey suggested that. One of our callers said that he heard Paul Harvey. I don't want to characterize Paul Harvey, not having heard it myself. Or obstructionists, you know, like obstructing civil discourse. Bill O'Reilly, if he had his way.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
Yeah, undermining is now a crime in the mind of Mr. Loofah Sponge, Mr. Falafel O'Reilly. Undermining, yep, send them to jail. Those clowns over at the liberal network, yes. All us liberal talk show hosts are quaking in our boots, Mr. O'Reilly. Fortunately, I mean, there are countries in the world where people couldn't do what I'm doing right now. I really value and love and honor this nation and value and respect the fact that I'm able to do what I'm doing. And in fact, the liberal talk radio, progressive talk radio, what I, you know, I call it uncommon sense from the radical middle, whatever you want to call it, can be heard in America. There was a long time when it couldn't. That wasn't because the government was preventing it. It was because the industry hadn't figured out that there was a market. But things change. People wake up. But O'Reilly would obstruct any voices from the left, clearly. I mean, if people are dragged off by the FBI in chains, I would say that they've been obstructed. The true obstructionists blocking, obstructing any movement toward a culture of life. Congressional conservatives voted down legislation to reduce unwanted pregnancies and abortions. And Bush is threatening to veto stem cell legislation. Well, they're willing to, you know, kill 100,000 people in Iraq. He was willing to kill over 100 prisoners in Texas. But save lives? Nah. Obstruction blocking an investigation of the detainee abuse allegations. There's been no independent investigation of the numerous allegations of torture and abuse in U.S. prisons, nor the potentially illegal practice of extraordinary rendition, the so-called extraordinary rendition, exporting prisoners to torture to countries where they will be tortured and murdered. And this is the kind of stuff you expect to have happened in Chile in the 70s, and did, you know. Not in the United States of America. U.S. forces in Iraq have no higher priority than developing Iraqi security forces. You would think, right? Developing the security force. I mean, how are we going to get out if we can't help them develop their own army? And yet the Defense Department is blocking, obstructing any attempt to determine the status of our training efforts or even to define what constitutes success by obstructing access to accurate reports of their efforts. Their data currently is unreliable and vague. Categories of analysis in the reports come and go without explanation. Go figure. Go figure. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Gene in Hillsboro, Oregon on the line. Hey, Gene, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just had a quick question. I'm still back in the eminent domain stuff.
Sure.
And I just was wanting to know, because I was listening earlier, and they mentioned the housing bubble breaking. And I was wondering how eminent domain and the housing bubble breaking might interact, or do they interact at all?
I don't see any clear connection, frankly, Gene, and I don't see this as part of some huge conspiracy beyond the, you know, creeping corporate encroachment of our government. And by the way, for our listeners who have recently tuned in, because we talked about this 2 hours ago in the first hour of the program, the Supreme Court today ruled that cities, counties, states, and the federal government for that matter, that governments may take your property against your will. And now, historically, they've been able to do this for the public good. And this is what it says in the Fifth Amendment, you know, very clearly and explicitly, that it can be done, quote, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Public use. In other words, up till now, governments could take your land to build a road or to put in a fire station, you know, because we agreed that there's some greater good that's served. But now, starting today, government, even if it's been bought off by these same corporations, can take your land to build a McDonald's, can take your land to build an office building, can take your land so that a private corporation can come in and make profit on your property. And it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. And I am completely astounded by, in my mind, it's wrong. I am completely astounded by this decision of the Supreme Court. And I can't figure out why the moderates on the court voted in favor of it and the conservatives, Scalia, Rehnquist, Thomas, all voted against it. And I frankly agree with Sandra Day O'Connor's dissent that this is going to help, you know, the privileged and the corporate class, period. Mm-hmm. And it's not a good thing for America.
Well, thank you. I wanted some clarification because I thought of that and I thought, gee, you know, that might just...
No, I'll tell you what's happening in the government in anticipation of the housing bubble explosion. And that is they've got Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae scrambling to cover their butts. And Standard & Poor's, which is not a government agency, but is a rating agency, is starting to say anybody who aggregates mortgage loans is going to have to come up with better credit standards, better standards than they have up to this point for reporting things like adjustable rate mortgages, because those things may go down when the housing bubble bursts. Gene, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We were born before the wind.
Oh, we were.
Also younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. My good friend Rama in our chat room says, let me get the scroll up here. By the way, you can get to our chat room by going to www.tomhartman.com and click live chat, and it will get you in there. He says, if a local government can force the sale of private homes and turn that property over to some corporation for its profit, there's absolutely nothing that would stop a local government from forcing the sale of a business property to build low-cost housing. Perhaps, if it was, I mean, for-profit low-cost housing. Historically,
you know, there has been nothing that has stopped government from forcing the sale of any kind of property to build low-income housing that's government-subsidized. That was covered under the right of eminent domain. But for-profit corporation. But see, the question is, you know, whose interests are going to be served? This is the point that Sandra Day O'Connor made, and I thought it was such a well-said point. And this is from her dissent. She wrote the dissent and was joined by Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas. And she said, and I quote, "Any property may now be taken for the benefit of another private party, but the fallout from this decision will not be random." Now, I am certain that the right wing is going to take this, particularly the right wing talk show hosts, are going to take this decision and say, "See what these liberals are up to?" You know, because it's the moderates on the court who voted this way. And I, as I said, I disagree with the decision. Of what I know of it at this point, my mind may change, but I don't think so. But what they won't quote you, what the cons will not quote you on the air, is the entirety of Sandra Day O'Connor's decision, because they're in the same pocket. They're going to give all kinds of, you know, strum and drong, storm and fury to this thing. But ultimately, she said, here's her entire quote. "Any property may now be taken for the benefit of another private party, but the fallout from this decision will not be random. The beneficiaries are likely to be those citizens with disproportionate influence and power in the political process, including large corporations and development firms." Large corporations and development firms. And, you know, spot on. I think she's absolutely right. Justice John Paul Stevens, for the majority, says the city has carefully formulated an economic development that it believes will provide appreciable benefits to the community, including but by no means limited to new jobs and increased tax revenue. In other words, you got a house, $100,000 house, you're paying $2,000 a year in property taxes. The local community says, you know, if we replace that house with a McDonald's, we could make $20,000 a year in property taxes. Tear it down! Hey, McDonald's, come on in here. You can make some serious bucks on this thing. This is scary. I got to tell you, I strongly disagree with this. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mark in Louisiana on the line. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Appreciate everything you're doing, man.
Thank you.
If I could, just real quick, I wanted to make a quick analogy and see if it made sense to you, and then I wanted to ask you a question about it.
Okay.
Let's say you have a kind of a crooked physician. You don't know he's crooked. You go to him, and he tells you that he has to perform this drastic, expensive, dangerous surgery on you, and it's a life-or-death situation.
Sounds like you're describing George Bush and Social Security.
Well, actually, my comment's about the Iraq War, but okay. It's kind of all the same thing. In the appointments with your doctor leading up to the surgery, he gives you three or four or five different reasons that make no sense for why you need this surgery. Now,
right.
And don't ask me why you would, but if you still blindly walked into that surgery anyway, let's say that you made it out by the skin of your teeth.
Well, this is the position Congress has found themselves in right now, and it's why they're starting to ask these hard questions of Rumsfeld like we heard today.
That's what I'm hoping, because the next thing in the analogy would be, well, let's say that some of the doctor's notes come to light where he's discussing with
there you
doctors,
go.
How can I trick this patient into going into surgery?
Yeah, it's a great analogy, Mark. It's a very good one, and I salute you for thinking of it. It's very well done. And it's right. And this is why members of Congress are going, hey, wait a minute. What happened here? We got snookered. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's no easy walk to freedom. No easy walk to freedom.
As a ghostwriter for Pat O'Brien's Access Hollywood. You didn't know that, Rama? Welcome back to our program. This an in-joke for the chat room. Sorry about that. It's welcome back. It's the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Senator Trent Lott talking about the John Bolton nomination. The Democrats are saying, we'd be pleased to give you a vote on Bolton. All you have to do are give us the documents that we've asked for, because we think that these documents may suggest that John Bolton was, number one, involved in fixing intelligence that led up to the war in Iraq, lying to, you know, the administration lying to Congress, and number two, that he was spying on people, and that he might even be have been spying on people who were his superiors, his bosses in the State Department, and, you know, getting, you know, secure intelligence on. We just like to know, you know, is this guy a wacko? Is he dangerous? Is he a crook? Has he committed criminal acts or not? Just give us the paper. If the papers, we know you have them, if the papers demonstrate that there's nothing wrong, then we'll vote for him. That's what the Democrats are saying. And Trent Lott, the Democrat from Mississippi, Republican from Mississippi, excuse me, comes out and says,
there are a lot of cases when executive privilege applies. There are a lot of cases when classified material would put people's lives at risk. Neither of those really apply here. So if it were my call, I would sit down with Chris Dodd and say, all right, now you tell me exactly what you want. I'd get it to him before sunrise, and we'd have the vote tomorrow.
Amazing. Trent Lott. Trent Lott. Now, Scotty McClellan, a little different story. Scotty McClellan, this is the White House spokesman. He says, it's clear that the Democratic leadership is not interested in finding a middle ground. They're not interested in information. The information has been provided and made available to people. Yeah. Yeah. Here we go. But Trent Lott saying, come on, just give us the information. Yeah, you know, we'll do with it. We'll work with it. This is incredible. Howard Dean, this is so cool. I got to say, this is so cool. My salute to Howard Dean. He is just, well, in fact, you know, we should play our Howard Dean alert music.
So I'm taking my country back.
We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
So I'm taking my country back.
Yes, taking our country back. Howard Dean leading the charge. And I play that not to ridicule him, but to salute him. I thought his yeah was wonderful. He had that crowd really whipped up. I think it's marvelous. In a defiant speech at a party fundraiser in Boston, Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean vowed Monday to continue his fiery critiques of the Republican Party and followed up with a pointed jab at Vice President Dick Cheney. He said, we are going to be much tougher and in your face with the Republicans when they say things that aren't true. This is in response to apparent response to criticism outside and inside the Democratic Party that he's using over-the-top language. Dean also responded directly to Cheney, who last week said of Dean, maybe his mother loved him, but I've never met anybody else who does. Dean says, I don't care if Dick Cheney likes my mother or not. We're going to fight back. He says, I think it's great that Dick Cheney went after me. At least they know there's a Democratic Party that's not going to put up with this stuff anymore. He added, as head of the Democratic Party, I will not be lectured about morals by Tom DeLay and Rush Limbaugh. Go get him, Howard. Well done. Well said. It's just really, really extraordinary. When you check out the news, you know, sometimes you think that it's just, is it reality? Is it like reality or not? Well, in fact, Danny Borowitz actually has an interesting story here today. Reality show producers facing severe shortage of real people. The number of real people in the U.S. at dangerously low levels, a study shows. This is from the BorowitzReport.com. Where have all the real people gone? That's the question reality show producers are asking themselves, as a new study released this week shows the number of real people who have not already appeared on a reality show dropping to a dangerously low level. The study commissioned by University of Minnesota's Reality Institute has caused alarm in the reality TV community, with producers increasingly fearful that real people, the bread and butter of the genre, may be becoming an endangered species. Dr. Corson McLeod, who supervised the study, said that the proliferation of reality shows on nearly every cable TV network has made it impossible, nearly impossible, to find an American who has not already had his home, car, or face made over by a team of experts. McLeod said, You take a random sample of 100 Americans, you'll find that 85% of them have either gotten married, competed for a modeling contract, or eating bug larvae on TV. The rest have sung The Wind Beneath My Wings. For reality show producers like Clive Lyson, who is attempting to launch a new program called Trading Medications, the search for real people to serve as contestants has never been a more daunting task. I have instructed my staff, he says, to conduct a nationwide search for real people. He also produced the hit movie series Pimp My Bride, and he said, we are going to look in every state but California. Elsewhere, Andy Borowitz reports, park rangers arrested Tom Cruise today after the actor attempted to carve Katie Holmes' face into Mount Rushmore. Well, it's good to know. It's good to know that these things are taken care of. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, toll-free across the United States. Paul in Santa Fe, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Yes, just noticing that, did you hear about Karl Rove's statement he made in a speech yesterday about the Democrats?
Apparently not.
Yeah, well, basically he said that the Democrats' response right after September 11th was, that they were ready to prepare indictments and offer therapy and understanding to our attackers. This is what Rove says the Democrats were going to do. And basically some of the Democrats, Harry Reid said that Rove should either apologize or resign, and Hillary Clinton. But basically this seems like Rove is sort of baiting them, you know, because that's Bush's strongest point is, you know, terrorism and the fight against terror.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, claiming they're wimps on chair, trying to get them to...
You know, they've been saying this for 4 years. I don't think he's doing it to try and get a response. I think he's doing it to try and continue to hypnotize the American people. It's, you know, if you repeat... He is doing what Goebbels said. If you repeat a big enough lie often enough, people will believe it.
But the Democrats, what they do is that they might raise a fuss for a day, then they drop it. They should realize they have to go after the propaganda and basically try and expose it, that they're so...
Yeah. Here's how it works, Paul. It has to do with the news cycle. If you and actually Arianna Huffington wrote a good op-ed about this yesterday on her blog. If you get a story out there and the national media doesn't pick it up within 24 hours, by and large, they never will. And so, you know, the Democrats can you know, fume and make up, you know, make noise about Karl Rove, but if it doesn't get picked up by the national media immediately, it's never going to happen. And now the second tier, that's the conventional wisdom and, you know, how it has been for a long, long time. Now the second tier to that is, on the other hand, if right-wing talk show hosts pick it up and beat it to death for a week or two, then it'll start getting picked up. Witness, for example, the Swift-Boat veterans attacks on John Kerry. And then the third level of this now is if enough blogs pick it up and beat on it, right-wing or left-wing, then maybe it'll get picked up. That's what happened with the Downing Street memos. So, if the Democrats want to make something out of Karl Rove's statement, they're going to have to either use left-wing talk radio or the blogs. And frankly, I mean, I'm pleased to talk about it. Here we are right at this minute. But it's just, in my mind, it's just another example of the hypnosis that the Republicans have been using, and not a particularly egregious one. It's just, this is just the standard Republican lies.
And, I mean, should they try and press it and do... like somehow up the ante, like they're going to do things in the Senate to, you know, I guess I'm wondering what can they do other than just raise a fuss for a day.
No, here's the rule of thumb in politics. Once you have to once you begin explaining, you've already lost. The minute you begin, Henry Ford used to have a sign on the wall in his office that said, never explain, never complain. And there's really a lot of truth to it. The minute that you begin explaining, you've lost. The way for the Democrats to respond to this is to attack. What the Democrats should do is say, somebody from the Democrats who can get national media, Howard Dean, Ted Kennedy, Joe Biden, whatever, some Democrat should call a news conference and say, I understand Karl Rove had something to say about the Democrats. And not quote him and not respond to it. Say something like, I heard that Karl Rove had something to say about the Democrats in 9/11. And we just want to be on the record as saying that the Republican Party and the Bush administration had over 50 memos, over 50 warnings that 9/11 was going to happen, and they did nothing to prevent it. And we think that that's a horrible, you know, the worst intelligence failure in the history of this country happening on the Bush watch. That's a horrible record to have.
and now put them on the defensive so they have to explain. Oh, no, we didn't get all those intelligence. Well, actually, we did, but, you know, we didn't understand what they meant. As soon as they have to start explaining, then you've won. That's how hardball politics is played, real politics.
Yeah, and I'm glad Dean is someone who seems to know how to take the offensive, even if I don't agree with him all the time. The fact that he's out there and he realizes it has to be, we have to go after him one way or another.
Yeah, and the way and I think that they're very, very weak on national security. I mean, the Republicans love to sit around going, oh, the Democrats, they're weak on national security. No, I'm sorry. The worst national security intelligence failure in the history of this country, the worst attack on this country by another nation since the War of 1812, happened on the watch of George Walker Bush and Condoleezza Rice and Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. And they should be held accountable for it. And nobody has ever asked them to be accountable for it. And when the 9/11 Commission tried to do the smallest of inquiries into this thing, they fought it tooth and nail for a year and a half. And they need to be held accountable for that. And that's what the Democrats should be doing if they want to win elections. And hopefully somebody from the Democratic National Committee or some Democrat with some cojones is listening. 1-866-88, and thanks for the call, Paul, and thanks for listening to KRS in there in Santa Fe. 1-866-889-8894, Roy, and also in New Mexico. Hey, Roy, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Kind of piggybacking on that and your comment about Howard, one thing, and it might just be because it's a little pride of authorship. I have been calling these folks the slime boat liars. I don't want to degrade the swift boat guys.
Yeah. Well, you know, the problem is, Roy, with name calling, that it immediately it puts you in a box. It immediately resonates with the people who are on your side, but the people who are in the middle go, eh? You know, it's. I think that, you know, Russia's feminazi stuff has caused a lot of people, a lot of middle Americans, to just not bother listening to Limbaugh, for example. And it's one of the reasons that I don't generally get into name calling here on this program, because it doesn't I don't think, frankly, it serves a useful purpose beyond, you know, you and me. I mean, you know, if you and I were having a beer, you know, in a bar, you know, yeah, you'd use it and I'd laugh and we'd, you know. But I think, you know, on the air when we're talking to people that, you know, you're using it, it's fine. But me using it, I don't think it's a good thing.
The Howard was on PBS last night on the new show, and he did a masterful job. What I liked was the calm demeanor. He was so composed.
Yeah.
And he absolutely took her presuppositions and just absolutely wouldn't buy them, turned them around, turned them.
Is this Gwen Ifill?
I don't know. The black gal?
Yeah, that's Gwen. I believe it's Gwen Ifill.
I don't know who it is. But
she's really quite conservative.
She was using all of the talking points, you know, the
Republican
talking points, and she just took them away, turned them around, and threw them right back at her. And she came back to the end, and she used the Roe quote about her, the mother quote, Cheney's quote about his mother.
Right.
And he said, yeah. He said, my mother, for the first time in 75 years, voted Democratic this year. That's what these Republicans have done. Absolutely lopped her legs right off from under her.
Yeah.
It was masterful.
Yeah.
And it was just, I was admiring him with the total, complete composure. His eye blink rate was just, I mean, you could have set a metronome by it.
Yeah. Well, Howard Dean has come a long way.
Absolute, total rapport and honest, he's got a great bedside manner.
Yeah.
I'm the doctor. I know what I'm talking about, but I care for you.
Yeah. Well, we had him on this program a couple of weeks ago, and when I was in Washington, D.C., I'm not sure if he was on in the morning on our local program or if he was in the afternoon on the national program.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was just sitting right there with me, a foot and a half from me. And I got that same. And, of course, you know, I've met him before in Vermont when he was the governor and I lived in Vermont. But I got that sense that this guy has got his act together. He's master of the universe now. He's figured it out. So, Roy,
I haven't felt this good since November 2nd or whenever it was.
Oh, yeah, and you felt bad then, you mean?
Yeah, just as far as crashing and burning. But I mean, if I.
Yeah, so you're coming back, in other words. Okay.
Well, I've been coming back, but he's just, the ship's in good hands.
Yeah, I agree. Roy, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate the call from New Mexico there. And a new poll just to completely change the subject here, I just want to drop this in. This is a small one, but it's an important one. A new opinion poll shows consumers overwhelmingly support country of origin labeling on food. Why isn't our food labeled to say, this is from Chile, this is from Argentina, this is from... And why isn't our food labeled to say whether or not it's made with genetically modified organisms? In Europe, food made from genetically modified organisms has to be labeled. Why not in America? Well, of course, the answer to that is because the big pharma companies and the big food companies who are genetically modifying our foods have fought tooth and nail against legislation like this. But the vast majority of Americans would like to know this. 85% are in favor of country of origin labeling, only 11% against. I mean, this is just, unambiguous. Why are our representatives not responding to the will of we the people and saying here's this is where it came from, let's pass some laws telling people here's where this meat came from, here's where this corn came from, here's where this kiwi fruit came from, it's so that consumers can make informed decisions. Why would they not want us to know this? This study, by the way, from Public Citizen, citizen.org, the organization that Ralph Nader created. One of the good things he did, a terrible thing getting into politics, nuts, but he did some very, very good work before that, and hopefully he's back to it. Anyhow, this is something that you might want to put a burr under the saddle of your elected representatives as well about. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square.
We can hope.
It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there.
It's on its way.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Yes, democracy is coming to the USA, sung by that brilliant Canadian, Leonard Cohen. But I'll take it from wherever I can get it. Speaking of wherever you can get it, the Young Republican National Convention was just held. And the official program of the Young Republicans National Convention was in the tradition of Republicans accepting money from corporations who wanted to buy ads in it, to support them. And so Adbusters Magazine, which is a corporation, said, we'd like to buy an ad. And the Young Republicans said, oh, cool, you'll pay? And the Adbusters said, sure. And they said, okay, submit your ad. And so Adbusters sent a full-page ad, big headline across the top, 20-point type, our nation is at war, ! And then there's like 5-6 lines below this that are spaced, they're about an inch apart. These are like, fairly large type, 16-18-point type, these 6 short lines, but with a lot of white space in between them, very easy to read. You can read this thing in a flash. It starts out at the top, our nation is at war. And then below that, as we get into the text, it says, we are in a desperate struggle for all we believe in. Keep in mind, this is for the program, the official program of the Young Republicans National Convention. Our nation is at war. We are in a desperate struggle for all we believe in. Our military is suffering a manpower crisis. Why are you here when your country needs you in Iraq? Talk is cheap. America needs more from you. College, family, and careers can wait. Heed your nation's call and enlist in the infantry today. The Young Republicans said, we are sorry, but we must regretfully reject this advertisement. We feel that the tone of it is too negative. Too negative. So, Adbusters has come up with what they call Operation Yellow Elephant. And their slogan, because ranting is safer than enlisting. So true. Ranting is always safer than enlisting. Thanks so much for being with us today. Tomorrow I'll be broadcasting live from Michigan, from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Visiting family, going to a wedding, giving a speech, and doing a radio show. And I'll be back here in Portland on Monday.
And we'll be back. But we'll have a live program tomorrow, so we'll see you then. Thanks for listening today, and talk to you tomorrow. Have a great one.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.